From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now tonight at the Democratic National Convention. Joe Biden's running mate Kamala Harris will accept her historic nomination to the ticket. Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama will also speak.
And last night we got a look at two competing wings of the party. A long time ago, it's ancient history now, but a Governor Bill Clinton was introduced to the country with a yawn-inducing lengthy convention speech. Last night, former President Bill Clinton was the elder, getting right to the point, comparing Biden's leadership abilities with President Trump's.
If you want a president who defines the job as spending hours a day watching TV and zapping people on social media, he's your man.
And progressive newcomer Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, with her one-minute speech seconding the nomination of former Biden rival Bernie Sanders, laid out her vision for the party, left her supporters demanding more airtime. Asma Khalid is NPR national political correspondent. Asma, were you struck by this old guard, new guard we seem to be seeing last night?
Yeah, though, Robin, I will say, I don't know that it's even just unique to last night. The overall tone that the convention's taken so far has been one, I would argue, that many young Democrats are saying is just too much nostalgia for them. There aren't very many, you know, convention speakers at all who are even under the age of 40. Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez was one of them, and they certainly wanted her to have more speaking time. But some of them have also expressed frustration that there are just, in their view, too many Republicans or, you know, some former Republicans who are getting airtime at the expense of some of the younger leaders of the party. And that extends even, in their view, to, you know, what we saw when we had a 17-person keynote speech, that you had all of these young rising stars condensed into one keynote speech. And when you have that, how can you really have a breakout moment for a young rising star the way that we did see Barack Obama have in 2004?
Yeah, it was like a chorus line. Well, Ocasio-Cortez spoke of the causes she feels were elevated by the progressive movement in the party. Let's listen.
In fidelity and gratitude to a mass people's movement working to establish 21st century social, economic, and human rights, including guaranteed health care, higher education, living wages, and labor rights for all people in the United States.
Well, so what do you think happens here, Asma? Is this a projection of the power these young progressives might have if Harris and Biden win? Because also the other element here is that Republicans are using AOC as a cudgel against the Democratic Party.
Sure, right. And I recognize that there is a liability in Democrats perhaps thinking that they might be overexposing themselves to the sort of concerns that the Trump administration or that Republicans have around some of the more left progressive wings of their party. But I would say, you know, whether or not it's AOC, there has been a pretty steady chorus among young voters, and I would say this predates even the convention, a frustration that they feel that the Biden campaign has not been reaching out to them so much. I mean, one of the more outspoken people I've seen recently on Twitter, she was actually the millennial youth vote director for the Hillary Clinton campaign. And she feels extremely frustrated that the Biden campaign has not reached out to young, persuadable voters. And they just don't feel like the outreach has been there by the Democratic Party to, you know, elevate and to contact these young voters. So what this will mean in the future, you know, who knows? I also thought it was interesting that one of the young people we did hear from yesterday was JFK's grandson. And for many of these young voters, that's not exactly who they see at this point as kind of the beacon of the future of their party.
Meanwhile, Politico called Jill Biden's address the speech of the night a passionate defense of her husband for rising above the deaths of his first wife and young daughter in that car crash years ago, and then recently after the death of their son, Beau, to brain cancer.
I know that if we entrust this nation to Joe, he will do for your family what he did for ours. Bring us together and make us whole. Carry us forward in our time of need. Keep the promise of America for all of us.
Asma, your sense of how she came across?
You know, Robin, she is really the most effective character witness that Joe Biden has. And I think that that is what we heard from her last night. She didn't spend an extensive amount of time. In fact, I don't believe she at all even mentioned Donald Trump by name. Her focus was to emphasize the qualities and traits that her husband could bring to the presidency. And as we heard there, she suggested that he is a man of good character who she believes would be able to stitch a country back together again.
No, Asma Khalid, we just have a few seconds, but Kamala Harris speaking tonight, I think we can expect her to mention Donald Trump.
I would imagine so. That is often the job of the running mate, is to be that prosecutor, you know, as she has been, and to make the case that the Democrats will be able to defeat Donald Trump and some of his weaknesses that the Democrats have been trying to highlight. So I anticipate you will probably hear quite a bit about him.
Asma Khalid, national political correspondent for NPR. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, as job losses mount and many of those with jobs continue to work remotely, nearly one-fifth of U.S. office space is expected to be vacant next year. That's according to a new forecast from Moody's Analytics out this week. Victor Kalinog is head of commercial real estate economics for Moody's and joins us now on Skype. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Well, and what do we know so far about the pandemic's impact on commercial real estate?
Well, interestingly, it's really hitting some property types much harder than others. I don't think it's going to be a surprise for me to share that retail and hotel are being hit disproportionately harder. For performance metrics in sectors like multifamily and office, it looks like the distress is not quite there yet, although there are some cracks appearing in the system.
Well, yeah, yet sounds like the operative word, because I imagine a lot of businesses that are using office space are waiting and seeing what happens before they decide whether they're going to stay in that office space or give it up.
Well, that's exactly right. And I think some businesses have already made decisions. For example, REI, that was building a massive 8-acre campus in the Pacific Northwest, built the suit for their organization employees, basically decided to walk away and said, we're going to put the property up for sale. And so I do think that the evolution of office space will happen a little bit more slowly as leases get renegotiated. But yeah, there's a lot of companies out there really thinking about, hey, do I really need this much office space now that we've proven that we can work from home?
So when will we know, do you think, or what are you forecasting in terms of when we will know what is going to really happen with office space?
I do think that the next 12 to 18 months will be telling. A lot of companies are trying to get back to the office. I think a lot of folks are realizing that there's a big benefit to working side by side in an urban setting, right? But will they be able to sustain this kind of working environment if reinfections occur? There will likely be lawsuits from employees thinking that they were unduly pressured to quote unquote go back to work. How do you handle that, right? And so there's a whole host of complications preventing employees from returning to the office. And our estimate is that there will likely be only between 20 to 25%, for example, of office workers returning to New York City by the end of the year. That's the largest office market in the country. And I'm telling you, it's likely going to be 75% empty.
And if it's 75% empty, that means fewer people going to all of the businesses outside the offices for lunch. Are we going to be seeing that, or are we already seeing retail space on the streets in cities start to go vacant?
Yeah, it's really under assault, particularly for restaurants and food services. These businesses are never run or rarely run with high margins anyway. Now that they're trying to reopen and they find out, wow, the ecosystem that supported my business in the first place, which depended on density and turnover, right? You don't want to keep that table occupied for too long. It's just not there. And it's going to be a real challenge.
Are you expecting a bounce back? Do you think that at some point over the next couple of years that all these offices will fill back up again?
We're not projecting an increase in vacancies to 100%, right? So we're not projecting that offices will completely empty out. But I think the interesting dynamic here is where will occupancies be relatively stable? So as in a quick example, if I have my headquarters in downtown New York and my employees are really hesitant to come over, but we still need office space, maybe we give up our space in downtown New York for cheaper suburban space 25 miles away, right? That cheaper suburban space may well actually be leased out in terms of a greater quantity, because now you can't pack people in cubicles anymore. You'll want 6 feet of space and so on and so forth. So I think it'll be a really interesting dynamic that we'll observe, particularly in the real estate markets, because it's hard to observe the movement of people and businesses in real time. I think it'll show up in the real estate statistics as to which geographies appear to be benefiting and which geographies appear to be hurting.
And do you have any guesses as to which will benefit and which will hurt?
Yeah, so in general, our forecast suggests that you're going to incur anywhere from a 14 to 15% decline in rents if you are in central business districts. If you're suburban office space, which represents about 65 to 70% of the stock out there, rents are also going to fall, but by an appreciably lower amount, anywhere from 7 to 8%. But central business districts are likely to be hit, at least in the short run, more severely.
That is Victor Kalinog, the head of commercial real estate economics for Moody's Analytics. Victor, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Drop that's made in alcohol. Late night long shots at the bar.
The new Old 97's record is about survival. Singer, guitarist Rhett Miller, bassist Marie Hammond, guitarist Ken Bethea, and drummer Philip Peoples have been making music together for 27 years since forming in Dallas in 1993. Their new music reflects the ups and downs of that journey. Health problems for Bethea and Peoples in recent years. Miller marking 5 years of sobriety. The new Old 97's record is called 12th. It's their 12th studio album. It's out Friday, and Rhett Miller joins us to talk about it. It's good to have you back on the show.
Robin, it's so great to hear your voice.
Well, yours too. So let's cut right to it. Is it a different voice? Is it, you know, we all know people who've gotten sober, and it, you know, you can either be a new, completely new incarnation of the old person, or how would you describe this for you?
It's a lot clearer out here, but as you alluded to in your question, sometimes that clarity brings with it its own set of problems because I have to suddenly, you know, look at myself as an artist and think, who am I? Was I always just someone who was leaning on this crutch of, I'm the party, I'm the life of the party, I'm bringing it. Let's sing about whiskey and weed, and this is what life is and fun is built on. And I love fun. I think music should be fun. I think live performances should be fun. And maybe the hardest part of all of it was getting used to the idea that there is fun that can be had that doesn't involve, you know, passing out at the end of it.
Well, we heard the song The Dropouts. One of the lyrics, "That's all right, turns out you don't need wings when you've got whiskey and guitar strings." Which would mean if you did the inverse of that, you can have wings if you don't have whiskey and guitar strings or something like that. But let's listen to a little of a song on the new record, which sounds like it reflects the new sobriety. You tell me. It's called I Like You Better.
I like you better than a six-pack of beer, and that's the perfect amount to make my vision unclear. But nowhere near enough that I don't think about you. And if I toss a few back, that's all I'm gonna do. So I'm fine if the tall boys all disappear. 'Cause I like you better than beer.
I like you better than beer, it goes on. Is this liking you better? What is this?
That's so funny that you pointed that out. God, it's funny. Just listening to that tiny clip made me feel weirdly emotional. I'm sitting in the exact spot where I wrote that and talking to you right now. And you may well be right because, believe me, I didn't come on your program intending to be some giant advocate for sobriety. And in my life, it's not like I'm, you know, a missionary. I think a lot of people can handle it. And I think for a while it worked for me fine, you know, and eventually it no longer worked for me. And but, you know, the terrifying thing when people look at a life without, you know, whatever kind of substance they're dealing with, it's once you're on the other side, it's really a beautiful place to be. And it's not as scary as you thought it was going to be.
Well, and back to this new album, which seems to be, you know, birthed in part by this transition you've been in. We see what you did here. It's called 12th. On the cover, there's Dallas Cowboys quarterback Roger Staubach, number 12. So see what you did there. And this has something to do, you told Songwriter, magazine with the idea that you grew up this artsy kid in Texas, and that was one of the few ways to bond with your dad over football.
Sports are something that my dad and I could talk about, and we weren't talking about why he didn't come home, and we weren't talking about, you know, how I wasn't going to be the attorney he wanted me to be, or the, you know, the football player he wanted me to be. But we could sit down on a couch and we could watch Roger Staubach, you know, throw a 60-yard pass to Drew Pearson, and we could both agree that that was awesome.
I want to listen to another song. This is Belmont Hotel.
Our love is like the old Belmont Hotel. It was in ruins, now it's doing quite well. The windows were busted, big holes in the walls. Madmen and wildlife was roaming the halls. Now there's a swimming pool with two waterfalls, and it's better than brand new now.
Now, you've said this song is a kind of a microcosm of the whole record. Are you also a renovation? I mean, what do you mean?
The Belmont Hotel was a motor court style motel in the 50s in a neighborhood called Oak Cliff, where Stevie Ray Vaughan grew up, coincidentally. But this motor court in the 1950s was not a fancy hotel, clearly. It was a motor court. Cut to the 1990s, when the old 97s were doing our first photo shoot. And, you know, some of our first band photos were taken in the parking lot of the old Belmont motor court. Then 15 years later, investors came in, bought the Belmont Hotel, and it's so beautiful now, Robin. It is like it's this really cool, hip, artsy hotel with a view of the Dallas skyline. And I was staying there one time, and it hit me as I looked out of the window onto the, you know, parking lot where my, you know, band had shot photos, specifically because of how terrible it looked back then. And now it was so beautiful. I just started thinking about the metaphor of it. You know, if you don't give up on something, and if you put in the time, and if you put in the work, you can take something that could easily be abandoned, like a band, like a marriage, and you can make it beautiful again. You can breathe life into it. And it was really moving to me as just sort of an object lesson. And I was so surprised that my bandmates liked that song, because it seemed like such a delicate little flower of a song. And they tend to go for the things that are more broad and muscular. But they did such a brilliant job of letting it breathe and letting it be this kind of beautiful, sweet moment in the middle of our album.
Great. Let's listen to another song. And this, I wondered how many people knew what a bottle rocket is. But here's Bottle Rocket Baby. So a little bit about Dallas there, and it reminds me, you guys don't all live there anymore, but you've been together as a band nearly 30 years. What's that like to have that long a relationship?
That kind of a shared history, it's like a lifetime together. I'll be 50 years old September 6th, and it's, you know, over half my life now. I couldn't have asked for better, you know, brothers. The life that we've shared has been so, I don't know, rich and filled with adventure. And the fan base that we've cultivated over all these years, and we've never really stopped doing what we're doing. And we've got now, you know, kids that are named after members of our band. We've got, you know, generations come, you know, together to our shows, or they did. It's a whole world of people, and I really care about them. And it's been a really sweet, beautiful ride. And I'm pretty lucky. Not many bands stay together for 27 years. And I'm not exactly sure how we did it, but knock wood. Thank goodness we have.
We're going to let you go, Rhett Miller. Beautiful new album. Just one very last thing. You also told American Songwriter, you are a songwriter, and when you write a song, you say, I'm singing this thing, but I'm trying to make something you want to sing too. Is that what it's about? You want other people to sing your songs back at you?
Once you've created it, you release it into the world, and it goes into the lives, the minds, the hearts, the ears of people. And ideally, it kind of takes root there, and it grows in them and becomes its own thing in their lives. And if they show up at my show, and I look out, and they're singing it back at me, it means that it's no longer mine, it's theirs, and they're giving it back to me. And that energy, honestly, Robin, that is the main thing I miss in all of this, is being able to go out and look at the people and congregate, come together with the people, and we're all singing together. I saw the list of the most dangerous things you could do to spread the virus, and at the top it was congregating in large groups and singing. I'm like, that's my job. That's what I do.
Well, someday, and now we all know we'll sing back. Rhett Miller, he and his band, the Old 97s, have a new record called 12th. Rhett, thank you so much for talking about it. It's terrific.
Thanks so much for having me back on here now, Robin. You're great. This is what we do. Oh, but somehow what we've got never breaks down, never breaks down. Oh, somehow what we've got never breaks down.
No, you're great. It's here and now.
London's Heathrow Airport, one of the world's busiest, debuted a new COVID-19 testing facility today. The news comes as the airline industry is trying to get governments to allow negative tests to stand in for mandatory quarantines for international travelers. Those orders have kept would-be travelers at home. Here and now, transportation analyst Seth Kaplan joins us now. And Seth, if you travel from one country to another right now, odds are at least one of them will require you to self-isolate on arrival. How much has that slowed down international travel?
Dramatically, Jeremy. I just took a look at the current data for this month, the number of seats scheduled compared to the same month, August of last year. Domestic seats are down 43%, a huge number, obviously. But international seats from the U.S. are down 80%, according to Cirium schedule data. So that's the difference between with domestic, just kind of having a comfort level with traveling, which obviously a lot of people still don't have. And with international, it just basically being illegal to travel or nearly so in a lot of markets.
So the airline industry is proposing this idea that a negative COVID-19 test on arrival would let you skip quarantine. Tell us more.
Yeah, or some variation of that, depending on what they can agree with governments. But right, they feel that these quarantines are just a really broad stroke that don't necessarily solve the problem. They feel like testing would really, in their view anyway, get to the heart of the problem. Of course, they're also trying here to stimulate demand, because essentially when you think about 14-day quarantines, I mean, most trips last less than 14 days. So that, you know, that would basically get it to a point where people would be allowed to travel again internationally, being virtually not allowed to travel to a lot of markets right now.
Well, and by the way, in Hong Kong right now, when you arrive at Hong Kong International Airport, you have to go get tested. Then you have to wait for your result to come back, which is supposed to come back within 24 hours. And then if it's negative, you then are monitored for 14 days and have to make sure that you quarantine. So you're doing both to make sure that Hong Kong doesn't see a spike in cases from international travel. But there is the issue of the test right now. You know, getting a test result back in a day is not exactly something that happens all over the place. What are the airlines doing to address the tests?
Yeah, not at all. There's also the question of the cost of the test, right? Who's going to pay? These are airlines that obviously wouldn't see themselves in a position to do that right now. You've got a test going on at Heathrow, a proposal there where you'd have a quick test when you arrive, results back, they say, in 7 hours, something like that. They say they can test 13,000 people a day right now. And then there would be a follow-up test several days later. And that's when you'd be released from quarantine, maybe 5 to 8 days later. So it's not as if you're just free, but rather in 14 days, maybe less than a week at least, if you have those two negative tests in a row, because obviously there's a question in the eyes of health authorities of perhaps false negatives.
You know, it's interesting. We're talking about this sort of as if you are the U.S. traveler going abroad. I imagine if the U.S. does get coronavirus under control and there are still countries out there that don't have it under control, this is really going to be an issue that the U.S. is going to have to deal with in our airports to test people upon arrival and make sure that
absolutely,
if, you know, we squash out the virus, that we don't have it come back in from an international traveler. Wow. Seth Kaplan, Here and Now transportation analyst. Thank you.
Thank you, Jeremy.
As the pandemic continues to dampen economic prospects around the world, the two largest economies are in a bit of a fight. China and the United States have been squabbling over the virus, trade, Hong Kong, and territorial disputes in the South China Sea. And Kevin Rudd, the former Australian Prime Minister, is worried things are getting out of hand. He's currently the president of the Asia Society Policy Institute in New York and has written about his fears in the current issue of Foreign Affairs, which we will link you to at hereandnow.org. Kevin Rudd joins us from Brisbane, Australia. Prime Minister, welcome to Here and Now.
Good to be with you on the program.
When you write that the growing tensions between China and the United States could lead to a crisis, even armed conflict, do you really see that happening?
The reason for writing the article is because I think the risks are now real. Political tensions between the two countries are at an all-time high, at least over the last 50 years. We're in the midst of a presidential election campaign in the United States, and Xi Jinping within Chinese politics is under internal pressure. So for those of us who look at this relationship closely, it's important to simply pose the question, be careful what you wish for at a time like this, because if crises erupt, then crisis management becomes very difficult indeed.
Well, our listeners obviously know about the domestic pressure on President Trump, but tell me more about the pressure on President Xi in China domestically as you see it.
Well, in the period since the COVID-19 crisis hit in China, Xi Jinping himself has come under considerable internal criticism over his own handling of the crisis. Then with the slowing of the economy, with rising unemployment, and of course further criticism as well in terms of the deterioration of China's relationship with a number of countries, not just the United States, but with Japan, with various countries in Southeast Asia, with India on the border, and with various of the Europeans as well, Canada and Australia, to be thrown into the mix. So for these various reasons, there has been a reasonably fast and furious debate underway within Chinese politics. Very little of this is fully visible to the external eye, but there is enough indication to suggest that President Xi himself is under some internal pressure, hence why questions which arise from a crisis are difficult to handle at times like this.
He's also facing an increase in the heat of the rhetoric from President Trump. Let's listen here to President Trump talking about the coronavirus, which he's called the Kung Flu and the China virus. Here he is speaking last month.
It came from China. It should have never been allowed to get out. They could have stopped it. They could have stopped it easily. They chose not to.
Does that kind of rhetoric matter in China? Does that matter in terms of the relationship between the U.S. and China, or does President Xi just see it as talk?
Well, in Chinese politics, when these things are said, it does matter within Beijing. And because of China's own sense of nationalism, responses therefore need to be delivered. Therefore, it does contribute to an overall further deterioration in the relationship. My overall point, however, in the article that I've just written, is that if the political nature of the relationship between Beijing and Washington continues to deteriorate, if you then, in that context, have an incident, an unplanned incident, an accident at sea or in the air, and there have been so many near misses over the last several years, then the politics of all this just makes it very difficult to handle escalation and then to de-escalate.
Well, when you talk about a near miss of ships hitting each other or aircraft hitting each other, I assume that the place where that would happen would be around these islands in the South China Sea or parts of the South China Sea, which China claims sovereignty over, even though a lot of neighboring countries also claim sovereignty over. What's happened with that area in the South China Sea during COVID-19 while we've all been focused on the pandemic?
In the South China Sea, where you do have multiple claimant states, the United States has intensified its number of freedom of navigation operations, deploying naval vessels through the area. Several years ago, there would have been about two such operations each year. Now we're up to about 9 or 10 per year. And also in the case of the U.S., they go within the 12-mile limit, which China has declared surrounding its territorial claims in the South China Sea. In response to this increased activity by the United States, there have been further deployment of aircraft by the Chinese Air Force. And on top of that, the United States has issued a change in its declaratory position on the legal claims or the foundation of legal claims issued by China about its territorial position in the area as well. Put all these factors together, it does contribute to a serious intensification. And that's why many of us who follow this relationship closely have been issuing alarms of one form or another.
What do you think could be done to de-escalate the situation between China and the United States, not just on the issue of the South China Sea, but also the trade war, also Hong Kong, also other issues that have come up between the two countries?
In the case of the overall U.S.-China bilateral relationship, the list of disagreements now of a fundamental nature is a very long one. Right across the national security space, right across foreign policy, economic policy, trade, investment, technology, Huawei, human rights, the list is formidable. If any significant improvement was to occur in the relationship, both sides would need to agree to push the pause button and to engage in some level of reset. As far as China is concerned, for example, a positive way to improve the relationship with the United States would be to stop any further repressive measures in Hong Kong. If China was serious about wanting to improve the overall dynamics of the political relationship with Washington, it could start by, as it were, de-escalating political tensions within Hong Kong itself. That would be positive across the board.
Do you think that China would ever do that?
In terms of how Beijing is now looking at the overall dynamics of its relationship with Washington, it is difficult to see what China's next steps will be. The next 3 months in the U.S. presidential election context loom as the most dangerous of all because the political stakes in Washington are high. And they are high in Beijing as well. On the Chinese side, I think they are trying to signal that they would like to see an overall de-escalation for the immediate period ahead. But speeches are one thing, concrete actions, for example, in Hong Kong, are another. We would need to wait and see.
I just want to ask you about one other thing while we have you, because you're joining us from Australia, which has had a very different experience with COVID-19 than the United States. It has been successful for the most part in keeping the virus from getting out of control. There have been fewer than 450 deaths in Australia. My question to you is, how do you think Australia has been able to do that? And also, do you think that Australia and the United States are going to be separated for some time to come because the virus is still so out of control in the U.S.? There's not going to be able to be the kind of travel back and forth that there usually is.
Well, COVID-19 has affected all countries. Australia has not escaped that. At present, there are still considerable concerns in Melbourne, the capital of the state of Victoria. However, the problem here in Australia is relatively small compared with what our friends in America have been going through. As for the future, in terms of the lifting of restrictions in travel between the two countries, frankly, that will depend entirely upon the further success by the Australian authorities in bringing the situation in Melbourne under control, and the reverse in terms of the principal arrival points in the US for flights from Australia. That is, what will the situation be in LA and San Francisco, in New York and elsewhere? I think we are a long way off. We in this country hope that we all get past this sooner rather than later.
Does it feel like a strange time in Australia, even though the virus is not nearly as widespread as it is here?
So here in Australia, it is very much an unusual sense of this country, which is a long way from most places in the world, feeling more isolated than usual. And we all look forward to the day then when all of us can get back to something which begins to approximate to normality.
That is Kevin Rudd, the former Prime Minister of Australia, now President of the Asia Society Policy Institute in New York. We will link you to his article from Foreign Affairs about China and the United States at hereandnow.org. Kevin Rudd, thank you for joining us.
It's great to be with you on the program.
And it's summer harvest in so many parts of the country, a burst of the familiar. Hello, cherry tomatoes. In a world where the pandemic has upended so much of our lives, corn, tomatoes, that overflow of zucchini that gardeners might complain about maybe in other years, but are treasures now, meaning the world is still on its axis. And here and now, resident chef Kathy Gunst has thoughts on what to do with it. Kathy, you have a gorgeous garden. We've been there. How's it growing?
Well, hi, Robin. It has been a very hot and dry summer. It's almost drought-like. The perennials are dying, but we have been out there watering and trying to keep everything going. And, you know, this is a difficult time for so many with fires and storms and drought. But if you're lucky enough to have a garden or access to fresh produce, this is a time to celebrate.
And we should say you're up there in Maine. Look, let's start. I could and do just take the tomatoes off the vine and chomp on them, but you have a new recipe. Let's hear corn and tomato tart.
Corn, tomato, and basil tart. And so let me just start by saying, buy a pre-made crust. No judgment. Make it easy as you want. If you want
to
make your own.
I am so with you.
I mean, listen, we need easy right now. Something to make life feel a little bit easier. This is a gorgeous tart that's quite simple. You shuck the corn off the kernels. You mix it with some eggs, Parmesan cheese, fresh basil, a little sour cream, and you layer it into the tart crust. You layer gorgeous ripe summer tomatoes on top, put it in the oven, and then just before it's done, you scatter some more raw corn kernels on top. So it's this wonderful combination of textures and sweetness and colors. And boy, this is a very, very delicious summer dinner.
And you know what? You can get the crust in a, not the crust, the, what are you talking about? The pie crust in a tin.
Yeah, pastry crust.
In a pastry crust in a tin, and you can get it just kind of rolled out. It's in the refrigerator section. It's fabulous. You know, it's just great. But you just said, you know, these corn kernels. You're talking to the person who had a great unfortunate butternut squash cutting incident. If you're cutting your own fresh corn, what's the best way without an unfortunate knife incident?
Quite simple. You go outside, work over your garbage pail. You want to strip the husks off and the silk, the thin filament. Then you want to take your corn, your cob of corn, put it in a large, deep bowl. And with a very sharp knife, you want to work your way down the sides of the corn, releasing the kernels. I usually have the narrowest part of the cob on top, work my way around, and then I flip it over in case I miss some because the corn is so precious. Very easy. And then don't throw away the cobs because you can make a very simple corn stock, which can be the basis of a chowder or a soup or a sauce, and you can freeze it for this winter.
Okay. Zucchini, let's move on. There's so much of it, but you have a recipe that isn't zucchini bread?
It is not, indeed. This is for a cold zucchini soup with basil and mint. Basil and mint are actually members of the same herb family, and they complement each other beautifully in this soup. Again, excuse me, this is a 10-minute soup. You saute an onion, you throw in zucchini or summer squash, fresh basil, fresh mint, whirl it up with some chicken stock, and then on a hot day, it is so refreshing, topped with a little Greek yogurt and fresh sour cream or creme fraiche. Really, really simple and delicious.
Don't people know that Kathy is on the air? Do not
I know.
Call
Who's
Kathy
calling me?
When she's
I'm sorry
on the
about
air.
That.
Listen, you said whirl it up. Do you mean in a blender?
Yes, a blender or a food processor, or you can use one of those wonderful tools called an immersion blender.
They are so great. You just hold them in your hand. This sounds like a great, if you're getting bored with cucumber soup, which I am, this sounds like a great replacement. Yep, go ahead.
Go ahead. Well, no, I just love this soup.
Yeah, and it sounds like a good cold one. You have a couple new recipes for corn, too.
Yes. Quickly, I did a spiced zucchini and corn relish. I used many of the spices from India, turmeric, fennel, mustard, and cumin seeds. I simmered those in some cider vinegar and then add chopped zucchini, onions, peppers, and chilies. Absolutely delicious on everything from a cheese sandwich to a burger to a curry to a piece of grilled fish. Very easy and simple. And then this was a revelation. I sauteed fresh corn kernels off the cob with a little bit of butter and fresh ginger and white miso paste. So miso is full of umami. It's very, very full flavored. And I thought, would miso and corn work? Well, the answer is absolutely yes. This is a 5-minute recipe that you can eat on its own. Again, sprinkled over grilled fish, ramen, soups, rice dishes, really straightforward.
I think that's something that Jeremy Hobson actually was working with in his kitchen. Jeremy?
No. I was just calling Kathy to find out about a good recipe to make for. Sorry, Kathy, that was me.
Check in so anytime, Jeremy. Anytime.
Here and Now resident chef Kathy Guns will have everything at hereandnow.org. Thanks so much, Kathy. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WVUR. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now.
I'm Robin Young. Former U.S. Surgeon General Dr. Vivek Murthy has long believed loneliness is a public health epidemic. But now, with so many of us physically apart, we could be at a turning point.
We can choose the path not of social recession, but of social revival, and can use this moment to ask ourselves where we want people to fall in our priority lists.
Next time, Here Now,